Hello, and welcome to the Strength to Be Human podcast with your host, author and playwright Mark Anthony Rossi. This show explores all forms of creativity for those searching for meaning and a place in the world. To err is human, but so is to love. Now, without further ado, here's your host.
Welcome back to Strength to Be Human. We have another wonderful interview segment here. I got Gabriel Ricard. He's a columnist out there in Long Island, also an author of a number of books, one of them being Bondage Nights. Gabriel, thank you very much for being on the show.
Well, thank you, man. It's good to be here.
Well, you have one hell of a resume, so I know there's a lot of things you could talk about, but that's one of the exciting things about having you on there. And each person I bring on there, they really do bring something new and refreshing to the show.
I just, God, it's just so depressing every time somebody says from Long Island.
Do you know how many people I've had on from North Carolina or from England or Ireland? I haven't had anybody from Long Island before, so I think this is great.
You're not missing much. You're not missing much. It's a dreadful place. I like the weather. I like cold, damp weather, and Long Island delivers that in spades. Past that, I'm not a huge fan of it.
Well, I'm originally from New Jersey, so I don't think we're too far away from a lot of these things, okay?
No, Jersey, you don't say.
Yep.
No, and I mean that in the best way possible. I actually like New Jersey, which is apparently an unpopular opinion. Which is really funny because Long Island, people from Long Island think they're superior to New Jersey. And every time I hear that, I'm the back of my head, I'm always like,
We get that a lot. I got that from this network. I sat down with them and literally the first thing they said to me was, we're not really expecting much from you in this show because all the other ones that we've had have failed. And also, you have such an unusual accent that you might scare the rest of the people away that who could be interested in your show because you sound like Tony Soprano's brother. I'm like, yeah, this is really helpful.
I was actually told this evening by somebody who knows these things that I have a no accent.
Yeah, you really don't really have much of an accent. On the other hand, I'm trying to tell these people, I believe the show is going to be successful and stop being racist against Italian people, okay? I mean, we're not allowed to read books and graduate from college? I'm just supposed to beat up people all day long? It's crazy.
I almost said forget about it, but I didn't. And then I did because I told you I didn't. But that's all right. I appreciate you throwing out the long resume compliment again and again. I don't feel like it. I just like to keep busy. I use the word lucky a lot, and I guess I've been definitely lucky to just have a lot of different outlets to do that. And I get, you know, people like having a weirdo around, and if you know a lot of trivia on top of that, it's a bonus.
Well, I've been saying on the show forever now, and I say it on the outside of the show too, that going into the 21st century, the way the publishing has changed and everything, if you don't have a serious work ethic, you just have no chance at all in writing. So people with longer resumes, they tend to have a really good work ethic.
On top of that, I'm a housewife and a damned good one too.
Well, what's wrong with that?
Absolutely not. I don't say it as a negative in the least. I'm just emphasizing just how gosh darn busy it gets. What was I going to say? No, it's not a negative at all. My wife works as a tour operator for a company that plans trips for schools, and it's an incredibly taxing job. So, yeah, and if you're home all day, you should be the one who does the laundry and all that.
I agree. It makes sense to me. You know what I'm wondering about is because I'm a columnist myself for an Indian publication, so I do columns weekly, and they're usually about ethics of one sort or another, whether they're scientific or personal or something like that. And some of that works into some of my other literary creative writing. But I'm noticing that you, they're much more diverse than that. So explain a little bit about the columns versus some of your books and everything, because it looks like there's a bigger difference there.
Oh, almost certainly. The columns are a very, I mean, it's a very creative concept. Both of my columns are about film. Captain Canada's Movie Rodeo is just a general review column of movies I've seen in the lifespan of the column, which would be from 2012 to present. When I started the column, I was trying to figure out what kind of pool to draw from, because I didn't see every new movie that came out, but I also saw a weird range of movies, and I wanted to do that. So I thought that's what Captain Canada's Movie Rodeo would be about. And I limited myself by starting with whatever movies I saw when I started the column. And then a few years after that, I got an opportunity to write a column for Culture Vultures called Make the Case, where every month I pick an actor or an actress, and I just run you through five movies that I think sums up why I consider them to be like one of the geniuses of their craft.
Gotcha.
And there's a lot of creativity in that. There's a lot of creativity in the stuff that you're dealing with and in how you express your opinion. But at the end of the day, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a columnist. I was a weird kid. But at the heart of everything, at the very beginning of practically my life, certainly my career, I wanted to tell stories. And I wasn't terribly particular about how I could tell stories. I wanted to draw comic books. I wanted to be a filmmaker. I guess it's just that thing where you just have a head full of weird ideas, and you've got to figure out a way to get them into some kind of format. And I was up for doing that with anything, and just to kind of, just tried anything that came along, and the stuff that people responded to was the stuff that stuck. So short stories, and then eventually my novel Bondage Night, and the other novels I've written that'll almost assuredly never be published because they're terrible.
You're funny.
No, they're pretty bad. And then into poetry. I've been writing poetry since I was. I've been a writer since I was 12. I've been writing poetry since probably 16 or 17, and I probably write more poetry on the creative side of things. I probably write more poetry than any other creative mode these days, mostly just because I don't have a lot of time to get into anything else. Novels take longer to write. Short stories take forever to write. And I've got, banal adult responsibilities to deal with. And I write for money. Sorry, what?
I said, yeah, we all do. We got those other things that non-literary is certainly not as exciting, no doubt.
And I do a lot of SEO writing and freelance writing for a bunch of clients, so that takes up a lot of my writing time. And, by the time you get through all the stuff that you have to do, I can't even stand to look at my computer anymore. So, it's unfortunate that it eats into your desire to tell larger creative stories. Not that poetry isn't expansive or large. But it's easier for me to write a poem than it is for me to write a screenplay these days.
I hear you. Well, sometimes that's not really a bad thing. I've known writers that write in various genres. I know I do. And oftentimes a poem, even if it's a solid self-contained poem, can also be a germ for something bigger later. So that's not really a bad way of going about it.
No. Bondage Night, for example, my novel, which is available from Moran Press, who have a number of other fine books out, including Ella. Bondage Night started as a poem, which eventually became a short story, which eventually became a novella, which eventually became the novel that it is now.
There you go, see?
So, yeah, no doubt. It's just hard to find the time for other stuff.
I have a show on time management, so it explains on things you could do to try to maximize whatever time you do have.
Oh, God. I got tired just hearing you say that, though. So,
but it's there because some people, they have a real issue with that, trying to figure out in a busy life how you can still stay creative or productive, you know, and produce, if not a lot, at least, you know, a steady amount. And that's really the best way of doing it. You have to manage your time better.
Well, and one thing that's also happened is I've started appreciating the creativity that I get to do in my columns. It's always been an outlet. It's always been a creative outlet. But the last couple of years, especially with Captain Canada and to a lesser extent with Make the Case, I've started appreciating because I always told myself that I had to do certain things in order to believe that I was a creative being. And I think one of the things that I'm trying to do as I get older is to let go of that notion and to appreciate the creativity that's afforded to me in the things that I choose to do, such as the columns, and to maybe not put as much pressure on myself to write the screenplay. I mean, I still want to do those things or that novel. I still want to write that stuff, but I sometimes wonder if it's an urgency on my part because I think I have to do those things.
Well, yeah, it's a good question. I think also to me anyway, the urgency sometimes it falls upon where you are at life. I know that for myself, I felt that as I gotten older, I wanted to get more things out there that maybe I didn't get around to do when I was younger because you feel more of the mortal coil of things. And also, you know, if you build enough of a track record, you're like, I got to fill that gap and I got to do this. I got to do that. So, you know, I did that for those reasons. And I'm happy with them because I wanted to be able to do other things and know that I've already done, you know, I did this novel. I did this screenplay. I did a few things like that I wanted to do. You know, now I could do a memoir, you know, next year once I'm finishing putting out the rest of the stuff I want to put out. Are you in a position with your columns that you could possibly collect them and put them into a small book? Because that's not a bad thing to do either.
Funny you should mention that. Actually, no, that's actually been a conversation that I've had with Stephen Moran of Moran Press. We're working on a short story collection that I'm putting out this year. But beyond that, because we're always talking about the book after that and the book after that, which is one of the reasons why I love Steven so much. He floated the idea of collecting each column into, you know, a couple of books. And maybe it's, and you know, if I'd known him and he'd said that to me 4 years ago, I probably wouldn't have gone for it as much as I like it, as much as I like the process of getting a book published. But over the last couple of years, I've started to appreciate the creativity in my columns more and what I can do in them. And I've started really enjoying the process of writing them more than I ever have. I've always liked writing them, but I've really started enjoying it the last couple of years.
Yeah, I think there's a real project there. I mean, you can put an elaborate introduction in there. You could put some notes in the back. You know, you could even add some stuff that maybe wouldn't be column-like in there as well, and make it something that's really valuable for someone to read.
Yeah, and the nice thing about the columns is that generally speaking, they're not very dated. I do an introduction. I do intros for each column, and for Captain Canada, I usually use the space to just ramble about something involving film, and sporadically that touches on things that are going on at the time, like the Oscars or something. But other than that, the structure of the columns, because Captain Canada, like I said, in the same column, you can have a review for the movie that just came out that Friday. And also a review of like an Ozu movie or like a Bergman movie or something silly like that, or like an obscure horror movie, you know. So it's just this wide range of movies, and which are always worth discussing, even when they're dated. you can still talk about a movie.
Yeah, exactly.
And make it relevant.
That's what I like about the movies more than other forms, is that it came out 15 years ago, and you can still make it relevant.
And that's probably one of the attractive things about writing about movies is the only things that can really be dated are your attitudes. Something you think now that's reasonably in the public, in the public arena of being an accepted idea, 20 years later can be seen as misogynistic or something along those lines.
Yeah, that's true as well.
You run the risk of that a little bit. So, but even so, there's an enduring quality to columns that I appreciate and that I can actually see making them worth putting in a book. So, yeah, after the short story collection comes out, which is probably going to be called The Oddities on Saturday Night, I think my next big manuscript project is, I'm going to pick one of the columns, probably Captain Canada, and see about a book.
Yeah, I like the idea a lot. I think it'll be an interesting project. I don't know anybody else is doing something like that, so that makes it, a singular in itself. And I think down the line, I'd love to have another show just about that. That'd be super interesting.
Yeah, Chip, you just got to say the word, man.
I don't get a lot of movie talk on this show, okay? So it would be kind of cool, too.
Well, I just finished writing a list article, actually, for Cultured Vultures. I've been doing a series of them lately where we just take a topic, a genre, and I run down the 15, my opinion of the 15 best films of that genre or type. Like, we did body horror. We did, I just finished one today for biopics. Just a bunch of them. The one for biopics was pretty challenging to write, mostly just because, they've been making biographical pictures for as long as they've been making movies.
Yeah, so you consider Gandhi like a biopic in that?
Oh, yeah, okay. Absolutely. Yeah. It didn't make the list, but
biopic. That's like a historic director, too. Oh, Lord.
Yeah, that was Richard. That was
Attenborough. Was that Richard Attenborough? Yeah.
Who I just saw in Jurassic Park the other day. I didn't hate the movie. I think it gets a little dry at times.
Well, yeah, that's the whole point when you do a biopic on somebody that's a major figure in history who gets assassinated. It's not the same thing as Johnny Cash, you know?
No, and it's not really even the structure of it. It's just that I think there could have been a little more more of an economical approach to telling that story. I don't think it needed to be what is that movie, 3 hours?
Yeah, 3 hours and I think 11 minutes.
Yeah, I think you could tell a good Gandhi story in like 2 hours. I think the movie meanders a little bit. I think that gets lost because Ben Kingsley does such a phenomenal job. And because the cinematography in that movie is just gorgeous, the way the movie, like every set design and every location they go to is just absolutely stunning.
Yeah, it's why it's more than a biopic. It's a very artistic type of film too.
And
so it's unusual in those biopic types of movies. Usually they're very very cut and dry, paint by the numbers type things.
The English like to take their time with those movies, though, don't they? David Lean was like that, too.
Well, they enslaved, robbed, and subjugated the people for a couple hundred years, so they might have felt a little guilt on that one thing, too.
Well, one would hope. It's a long list, and it's like 60% of it isn't very good. But the best biopics, and I don't want to give too many away, but
you don't have to do that. But at least mention one or two.
Well, I can tell you, I'll tell you a runner up, and I'll tell you one that actually made the cut. One of the runners up, because we do, I started including runners up because there's just so many movies to choose from.
I know, it's one of the a common up, thing these days. Yep.
Oh yeah, it has you know.
I do this. I hear a lot of this on the music level, where I'll have someone do a top 10 of something, but then they wind up having like 5 or 6 honorable mentions because it's just so hard to pick.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I cheat a little bit because the lists are all chronological. They're not actually ranked, which gets a little tiring explaining to some people sometimes, but that's okay. Not to go too far down a tangent, though, too far down a wormhole. There's an incredible documentary that Martin Scorsese made in the 90s called A Journey Through American Movies. And it's like 11 hours long or something like that. It's like 8-11 hours long. It's very, very, very long. And it doesn't even cover the entire history of American movies. I think it stops in like 1950 or 1960. And Scorsese mentions that at the beginning of the, at the top of the documentary. And he just kind of very sheepishly goes, just, you know, I can only talk about the movies that mean something to me. I can't do the whole history as I want to tell it because I just don't have time. And that's the thing that if you're like way too into movies, that's the thing you have to face every time you go to make a list or write an article or a column or whatever. But one of the runners up for the biopic list is American Splendor. And one of the movies that actually made the cut was Frida.
Hmm. Well, that one I liked. All right, that one I liked.
Which one, Frida?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's hard to go wrong with an interesting woman like that.
Well, and it's directed by Julie Taymor, who has a pretty interesting track record herself. She directed 1999's Titus with Anthony Hopkins. It's anchored by some really good performances too. I mean, Selma Hayek's at the center of it for sure, but you've also got really good stuff from Alfred Molina, Ashley Judd.
Like him a lot too. That's a solid movie all the way around. And I'm glad they had a strong cast, because it really would have disappointed me if it had such an interesting subject and topic and then have a bunch of boneheads around it. So I'm glad that it was consistent all the way through.
And it's a mesmerizing movie. I've seen it a couple times. And unfortunately, like most really good biopics, it's fairly depressing.
Yeah, you ever see the one from Pollock? You want to drink after watching that one.
Oh, with Ed Harris?
Yeah.
Oh, God, yeah. But I think Pollock sucks, so.
Yeah, a lot of people do. But I like the movie a lot, and Ed Harris is wonderful. But, Jesus, that was like, give me a bottle after this movie.
Yeah, you can see why people who did, even if they drank a lot, it seemed to go up around that guy, around Jackson, and because it's, and Ed Harris did a great job of conveying this in the movie. It seems like Jackson Pollock was kind of a stressful guy to be around.
Yeah, that's one word. Yeah. He makes Picasso look like how good housekeeping, you know?
Well, they thought he was, I know as a kid, apparently they thought he was like brain damaged, or that, I know somebody in his life thought that he'd either end up in the ditch or the grave. Because he was seen as like this simpleton.
I'm not too surprised. Remember, they wrote off Einstein as being a dummy. Einstein.
Yeah. Yeah, that. See how that panned out.
Yeah.
Nobody ever heard from him again. But so that's the next one, and then just did war movies. Just did body horror. It's been fun going through these dark comedies. We did one, it's going on top of everything else, but, and I usually hate writing lists, but Jimmy Donnellan, and God, I hope I get his name right. Jimmy Donnellan at who runs Cultured Vultures asked me if I would do one, and I didn't, you know, I guess it was a slow week or something, a rare slow week. So, because I said sure, and I've written like 12 of them since in the last 3 months or so. And I used to hate writing these things, but I've almost think I'm addicted at this point.
Well, they sound fun, actually. I don't know how fun it is to put together, but it sounds fun when you talk about
putting
it.
Them together is stressful. Let me sorry, no, because I wind up watching clips, and I do way too much research, and because I'm always really research oriented, because I have to be for work. So I watch clips and I like pour through lists and all this other stuff, and it's definitely left me with some weird head spaces. Like when I did the body horror one, which would be movies like The Fly, or Society, or Tetsuo the Iron Man. Or Alien. If you watch a whole like day's worth of clips and then write analytically about these movies for like 5 or 6 straight hours, it messes with your head a little bit, and maybe that's another thing that appeals to me.
Well, I've heard that one before, but I guess it makes some sense.
Watch like 3 David Cronenberg movies in a row. You'll get it.
I always liked him, but he doesn't have enough of a track record to really love everything he's doing. He's kind of a little off here and there, but some of his stuff I really appreciate, especially his version of Nightbreed from Clive Barker. I thought that was right on target.
Well, he didn't direct that. He just acted in it.
Oh, that's right. I thought he directed that.
No, he's a marvelous actor. He plays very specific types of characters, but I've seen him in 2 or 3 things now. Nightbreed is probably his biggest role as an actor, but he's a very effective actor in the right kind of role.
He's only done a few, because most of the times he's usually directing some strange horror movie, like, you know, like Scanners. I always liked that one, and I know he did The Fly. Yes, right.
He's still, most of his movies are still good. They're just getting the body horror is getting more and more internal, is what's going on, seems to be going on
well,
with
I
David.
Thought, I thought Videodrome was really more visionary than they've given it credit for.
It started
really
to get credit.
Yeah.
Him and John Carpenter, there's been an even bigger, they've always been cult movie figures, and certainly David Cronenberg has gone on to be Academy Award nominated for stuff like A History of Violence, but critical assessments of those earlier, more maligned movies has really, really sprung up. I know the Cannes Film Festival is giving Carpenter a special award. The critical assessments of David Cronenberg's earlier movies is getting more and more glowing, and his work is finding increasing his early work is finding increasing social relevance in society today. It's really cool to see that.
Yeah, I've always liked him. He's just definitely eccentric and a little.
He's
hard.
A nice young Canadian. He's a nice young Canadian man.
There you go.
he's what? Yeah, no, there's a lot of weird horror movie folks from Canada, which I love.
Yeah, really,
being from the country myself,
they really are, because when you usually think of people eccentric, it's often the British, not the Canadians. Canadians tend to be. More level-headed. That's usually how people view them.
Yeah, no, generally, we usually exclude Quebec from that part of the conversation. But overall, yeah. Well, comparatively speaking, it's, you know, when you compare like social psyches to the United States, it's always, especially in Western countries, it's always a little hard not to go, well, this place is much quieter.
Yeah, that's generally true, too. I can tell from writing. Oftentimes, I can tell people who are Canadian, even before they mention it, just from the writing, because there's something different about the Canadian thinking than an American thinking.
Oh, yeah. And which I have noticed, and that might just be that, like, national identification thing, like, especially if it's a Canadian writer who's from the parts of, because Canada is not a town of 500 people. It's a pretty big country.
It is.
And it's got different regions and dialects and cultures and such, like the much same as the United States. But there is, but Canada has that, does have that really subtle national identity thing. And so I do feel what you're saying that Canadians write a certain way in most of the Canadian writers that I like, but I'm particularly fond of Canadian writers who worked, you know, near to where I was born or near to where I grew up.
Well, that's cool. We don't really hear enough about them. And, other than the ones that have made it really big, you know, like the lady from the Handmaid's Tales. But to me, I read a few of her projects, and I'm not as interested. I actually really prefer Canadians when they're involved in music. I think they bring a lot more out than they do writing for me.
Well, that's true, in spite of the fact that some of Canada's most wretched imports are musicians.
Well, I mean, I think Russia's brilliant. And there's just nothing. There's nothing I like them in the world, and probably never going to be. So, is a perfect example of a real interesting and intellectual band.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about this Bondage Night. Is it about people having bondage issues, or that's just the name of the novel?
The name of the novel is loosely based on it's a summation of several relationships I'd been in with women, and it's also loosely based on the night I was hit by a car.
So this is all metaphoric, and there's nobody being bonded in any of this thing, right?
Well, hold on there.
Oh boy.
The title of the novel, though, is taken from, because it's you know, like a lot of those kinds of, like a lot of these kind of like dark romance novels, bad romance novels, you know, it's usually it's hopefully a combination of people, and that's definitely the case here. But you know, I still distilled all that down into two characters, Leo and Laura, and the title of the novel is taken from an event they go to at a bar in the city they live in that's called Bondage Night, which in of itself is loosely based on a couple of different bars I know that I've gone to that have done bondage themed evenings. So those definitely happen. Bondage Night, there is a Bondage Night in the novel. Wow. It's obviously, there's obviously a larger metaphor at play there, but there is in fact a Bondage Night, and there is in fact some light bondage.
Oh, great.
Very light though. It's, actually a lot of the sex stuff got cut over the various drafts, which is probably for the best, because like most, you know, mostly straight white guys, I can't write sex for nothing. I'm not terribly good at it. So that was probably for the best, but there is actual like bondage in Bondage Night.
All right. And you said it's like like three or four different tales over the course of the novel.
It's broken down into three parts. The first part is before the night at the bar. The middle part is the night at the bar, and then the last part, of course, is everything that happens after that. You know, after the car accident.
Does it end with a car accident, or is that just one of the last stories?
That's in the middle.
Oh, it's in the middle.
That's in the middle, because the incident in question occurs on Bondage Night, because the evening amounts to be a very long one.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And speaking as someone who's had those long evenings, we were talking about, you know, getting adult responsibilities and stuff, and you can't help but feel a little boring sometimes, but at the same time, I remember those long nights, and I'm rather grateful I don't feel the need for them anymore.
No, I can hear that, and I can understand intellectually and even academically how somebody can do 3-4 months of child rearing and laundry and work and all this other running around stuff, and then one day say, hey, wouldn't it be nice to go to a bar and, you know, get wrapped up a little bit in some chains and get smacked around with leather for a night? I mean, it's probably a lot more interesting than laundry. So I could see why somebody might think that's a good way to get out of their life for a while and get into something else. It's sort of a role-playing fantasy thing. You know, I don't know how regular you want to do something like this, but I could see why somebody would be interested.
Let me tell you, I've been in and out of BDSM communities over the years, and there's definitely people who make it a very meaningful part of their lives.
Yeah, I can imagine. But, you know, I just turned 54 today, and I know a lot about bondage. It's called marriage and having a mortgage, so I think I got that down pretty good.
Well, I'm lucky. I'm a millennial, and it's literally impossible to buy a house. So I get I just pay rent, so I'm lucky in that sense. And I'm also probably almost certainly sterile from, you know, 20 years of having laptops in my lap. So no children.
Or eating Hot Pockets, one or the other, yeah.
My wife and I have ferrets, which are pretty stressful to take care of in their own right, and also, objectively speaking, better than human children.
Yeah, I'm sure they're cheaper too. So,
They're still $15,000 over the course of their lifespan.
For a ferret?
The rough estimate for taking care of a ferret properly over the course of its life, which is anywhere from 7 to 12 years, is approximately $15,000.
Yeah, that's kind of rough. You might want to go with a cat and give them some Walmart food. Still have a lot of fun.
No, they'll also die 3 years earlier.
probably true.
Ferrets are so terrible. That's another thing. I can talk about movies and ferrets forever. Ferrets are so terribly inbred that their stomachs are all screwed up. They have a lot of health problems, which is where a lot of the costs come from. Probably. They're also still qualified as exotics.
If you're going to sleep with your sister, this is what can happen, you know?
Well, that's what breeding mills are.
Yeah.
You got the same problem with dogs, just it's worse and more elaborate because we're talking about different breeds.
That's what they do, and I honestly think it hurts the animals. I know there's a profit margin in there, but you know, these animals are not really meant to intermix that closely.
It's destroying them. It's like if you look at a picture, I think the breed I'm thinking of is a boxer. If you look at a picture of a boxer today and a boxer 100 years ago, they look like two completely different animals. And in a lot of ways they are. We've just like devastated the dog breed. Oh. The dog is an animal.
Boy.
Some breeds do okay with it, but it's still the whole concept of a pup of any animal mill is in of itself incredibly inhumane just because of the conditions to make those profits.
I believe it.
I say all this, but I also eat fast food, so don't pay too much attention to me.
There's nothing wrong about talking about, you know, that there's some real unethical practices going on. You hope that eventually the people or the authorities will look more and more into that. I know that they seem to be doing that more and more these days, but hang. Some of the other problems going on, it's probably not exactly on the big list of the police department. Let's go check out this puppy mill today. Let's not worry about those rapists at the moment, you know. So I can understand why it's not exactly the most pressing thing.
Well, and the upshot too is the upshot of climate change is that, you know, if we don't fix these things ourselves, you know, nature will hand us a comprehensive solution. So, you know, one way or the other, it's going to work out, I guess.
Well, that certainly is one of the more original concepts I've heard this week. Taking care of animals for climate change. So that's a hell of a topic right there.
Yeah, you want to run with it, man.
That's deep.
I'm busy. I got work tomorrow, you know.
So I know you're putting together this short fiction collection. So was it coming out in the fall of this year?
That's the dream. My most pretentious contribution to the process of bringing a manuscript to publication is the cover. When I was a very little kid, I wanted to be a comic book artist. My hero was Jack Kirby, but it didn't work out. But I've always been a frustrated artist on the inside. And these book covers are pretty much the only opportunity I've really had in my career to collaborate with artists. So I kind of take advantage of it. And so that's why, as proud as I am of the content in the books, in Clouds of Hungry Dogs and Love in Quarters and A Ludicrous Split with Kevin Ridgway, as much as I love the content of those books, the covers is of a unique significance to me, because I get to work with amazing artists like Joan Comics and Frankie Matt and Raymond Kilburn.
Well, that certainly is original here, Gabriel, because most writers I know, they hate dealing with any of that stuff and don't have any notion about it and farming out to somebody else. So what does this mean for you in terms of the writing? Does this mean that you don't have all the fiction pieces put together yet for the book and you still have to get a few more?
No, the fiction's done.
Oh, good, good.
The fiction's done. Well, the stories are assembled and I've edited them. I was going to take another pass through the book, which is one of those things that I keep putting off, but I will do it, by God. And hopefully around the time I finish doing that, I'll have the cover done. And I'm really going into a decidedly, if you've liked the covers of my books, this next one's just going to probably blow the hair back off your head, because it's definitely my favorite cover. If it comes together the way I know it will, it's going to be my favorite cover to date. But the stories are done.
Well, the Bonds at Night one is pretty, it's pretty damn interesting. I can see some of the Japanese influences on it, but then also it has almost a movie picture quality to it as well.
Well, that's Joan Comics, who's been a good friend of mine for over a decade, and we've been to more than a few bars together, and so she knew exactly what I wanted to do when I was coming up with the idea for Bondage Night.
Yeah, it's great. It's professional. It's got a poster feel to it. Kind of almost a magma comic Japanese thing, but it's not too out there. It's not too much like it's feeling like it's, you know, it's completely apen. It still feels distinct and everything. I like it. It's interesting.
Well, and again, like, of course, obviously, I believe in the stuff that's inside of it. I'm particularly excited about the short story collection, because that's been on my dream list. That's been on my writer's bucket list for almost as long as I've been a writer. And of the 30 or 40 unpublished short stories I have, I picked 9 that I've always wanted to see find a home, and they didn't, because that's the that's the submission process. But the 9 I've picked, I'm really, really proud of, particularly the title story, which, again, will probably be the oddities on Saturday night.
Are you going to get her to do this one as well, or you got somebody else in mind?
Well, I don't, you know, it's not that the mystery really matters, but I don't want to say just yet.
Oh, okay. That's fine. I wasn't sure about that.
I'm not building any kind of reveal up. I'm working on it. And I haven't talked to everybody I want to talk to yet, and that kind of thing.
Well, I thought it was unusual, because at the time, I didn't know that a woman drew it, but I had that feeling, because when you look at it, you look at the bondage, and there's the act of bondage going on in the actual cover, but it's Absolutely. Done in such a tasteful, almost secondhand manner that you have to wonder if a woman did it, because I honestly think if a guy did this, they'd be a lot more graphic and it'd be up more front than it is here. So it's interesting how she did that. It covers what you want, but it's not in your face.
I think only a woman could have done a cover. I think your observations of the cover are just spot on, man. And I think only a woman could have captured it in exactly that way. I wasn't thinking when I asked her that I wanted a woman to do it. I just thought, for a number of reasons, she was the perfect person to do it. And if I can throw just a little plug out for her.
Yeah, sure.
Joan Comics, Joan Comics, Comics. She's got a Patreon that she updates constantly with art just like that. Better stuff than that, honestly. Her talent is immense, and I'd love to see her get some more support.
Yeah, why not? She's very interesting, and she's brave enough just to take this topic on, because I can guarantee you that you probably have some female artists out there, regardless of if they want to make this, their salary job or not, that they might not have wanted to take the assignment, because, you know, they might not have been able to figure out how to do it in such a way that covers what you need, but still doing it in a tasteful manner. That's not disgusting. It's classy. Well, it's classy what she did. That's what I like about it. It's classy.
It's not exploitive.
No, exactly. Imagine bondage being classy, but she did it.
Not that I'm against exploitation. Well, exploitation movies, but that definitely, Bondage Night is not an exploitation novel. It's not a sensationalistic novel. It's,
I don't doubt that, but you know, an artist could have went that well just for the cover alone and give it a whole different feel than it would have had.
Well, they wouldn't have gotten very far because although Joan completely surprised me with how the cover turned out, she still worked from the vague ideas I had. So I don't think a cover like that even would have ever made it past like the
I'm glad it didn't, because I always think that a cover should generally reflect, if not emotionally, psychologically, what the book's about. If it goes off too much, then
exactly.
To me, it's just not an honest way of going about things.
Artistically. No, it's not. It's not. You're absolutely right. And I am so grateful to Joan for conveying everything that the book is about.
Well, she's super, no doubt.
Think that, so, and that may be one of the reasons why I obsess about the covers, but I'm very excited for the oddities on Saturday night. I'm really, really excited about the cover.
Well, that's going to be great then. And are these short fiction stories, do they have a certain theme that links them together, or are they all just really different?
Shitty white dudes trying to be less shitty is a common theme, but there's stories with that try that slant with female protagonists as well. It's a recurring theme in a lot of my creative stuff is people who are in the process of doing terrible things with their life, in the process of trying to do better, and the consequences of that, and the potential upsides of doing stuff like that. And because there's always consequences, because you usually don't get to be a better person unless it's the expense of someone else's happiness or sanity. And I've always tried to come to grips with that. And Bondage Night very much tries to do that while also trying to get at toxic masculinity a little bit. But one of the recurring themes in the short stories for sure is people trying to come to terms with themselves and the consequences of that, as well as the good things that can come out of it.
Are they just trying to discover themselves for the point of discovery, or are they trying to learn some lessons that maybe improve them later on?
Well, as is often the case, I don't think people usually don't go out looking for lessons. Well, they do, but usually the most profound ones are the ones that they're fortunate enough to come across in the course of just discovering things for the sake of discovery. And that's fine. But what happens then is, what do you do with that information?
Right.
And I've tried to, in my own personal life, I've tried to be somebody who's put that information into hopefully being a better person, into trying to be a better person, while also being cognizant of what my life has done to the people around me.
Yeah, that's one of the definitions of being a writer.
Yeah, it is. I'm not very cerebral or clever, you know, like what with me generally what you see is what you get. And so I tend to deal in very straightforward stuff. Hopefully in a way that, you know, people still feel engaged by, which I guess they do.
Yeah, I mean, you have had a lot of good selections on what you've done already over here, so I can imagine this next project. And I also like the fact that it's a bunch of different pieces of short fiction. I always like short fiction collections because I always feel, just as a consumer, that I get the most bang for my buck. But also artistically, I like it because you're going to find that if you have 30 or 40 stories in a book, you're going to find a couple that really ring true to you, really ones that you enjoy the most, because there's always something in that collection that makes that person stand out. No, nobody does 40 great pieces. It just doesn't happen. But you'll find a couple that are like, oh my God, it makes worth it the whole book. And that's always fun to discover, to find which one that's going to be.
Raymond Chandler got close. he got close to 40, I'd argue. But I do agree with you. Actually, in Raymond Carver as well. Many other Raymonds, but specifically those two.
Yeah, Raymond Carver would be a little bit more towards my own generation of people who I read.
I grew up on Raymond Carver as well,
yeah,
for sure.
So I always appreciated him, and I always wished he didn't die so early, because he could have had a lot more material out there. That's for sure. But
he certainly got a lot out, though, which I'm grateful for. That's one of the many literary influences I got from my mom, who's also a fantastic writer in her own right. Yeah, I grew up on stuff like Raymond Carver. Like that was just, those were the books that were laying around. So that was the stuff that I wound up reading.
Yeah, I don't get too many people that know much about him anymore. I almost never hear his name out there. Most people have gravitated to flash fiction, which is great. I love it myself. And it's far from anything he would have done.
I think we're both for it.
Yeah, I love it, though, and I definitely think that you need to have new forms on a new generation or new life. You can't be in 2019 writing Raymond Carver stories. Not that there's anything wrong with them. It's just that they wouldn't simply ring authentic to all the things that have happened in the world so far.
Well, I think hopefully there's a little bit more room, because my short story collection, I definitely don't focus on the same characters as hard as Raymond did, but I definitely started writing short stories. One of the biggest influences on my short story writing was Raymond Carver, and at a very early age, I think I read Cathedral, I think that's the name of the book, or Come to Where I'm Calling From.
That's the one I have in my collection.
Yeah, I got the Library of America editions, so I've got everything. But Come to Where I'm Calling From, I think I read that when I was, I want to say 13 or 14.
Yeah, it's just definitely one of the early greats of the more modern writers.
And then I saw the movie Shortcuts around the same time. Did you ever see Shortcuts?
I did.
Man, that's a chilling silence. Can I take it then? You don't like the movie?
Yeah, it didn't really connect with me. It kind of felt just Hollywood pretentious. I'd just rather read him.
Robert Altman definitely has touches of that, especially in some of those bigger ensemble things he did. I'll try one more on you, though. Did you see Everything Must Go?
No, I haven't.
Well, it's based on the Raymond Carver short story, which I think the short story, it expands on it a lot, because it's an 80-minute movie, but it keeps the core ideas in, and it's the one about the guy who's locked out of his house on his front lawn, and he's got all this stuff with him because his wife picked him out. And he has nowhere to go, so he's just sitting there drinking beer.
Yeah, it probably sounds autobiographical too. Nolan Carver, jeez.
Oh yeah, they made a great movie out of it with Will Ferrell.
That perfect guy for it too.
I recommend it highly. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, check that out. Thank you.
No problem. I can't not recommend movies to people. It's borderline obnoxious.
No, that's fine. I always have certain ones that are very close to my heart. Especially one that very few people know about. It's called The Knife Configuration. It's William Peter Blatty giving a shot to direct a movie based on one of his early novels, and this one is just as terrifying. Discovering the devil and then discovering God, and this movie is pretty much the anti-exorcist, and it's just as deep and frightening and funny and a little bit of everything. But
what's interesting about Knife Configuration, though, is that it's set in the same universe as The Exorcist.
Yeah, I mean,
because it's the astronaut.
It is, but it's ultimately a movie about finding God and finding faith and losing faith. And it's you don't get too many movies like that at all. The cast is tremendous. you know?
Stacy Keach.
Moses Gunn. It's like everybody and their uncle was in this movie.
Miller.
Yeah, this is everybody's in that movie. And at times it can make you laugh really good. It has some real funny stuff in it as well. But
William Peter Blatty, I wish he had directed more. Because Ninth Configuration was great. He also wrote and directed The Exorcist 3 from his novel Legion.
I like that movie a lot too, Exorcist 3.
I think Exorcist 3 is one of the best horror movies of all time.
It's really good. If people pay attention to it, they can really get a lot out of it and understand more about the background of the first one. But you know,
in a lot of ways, I like The Exorcist 3 more than the first one.
Yeah, I hear that a lot. I liked a lot. I just really, really liked that movie, and he was really an interesting director. But I got a feeling that he only cared about directing because of, I think he only cared about directing because those were his projects, and he wanted to just make sure that those things were not screwed up by Hollywood. Otherwise, I just don't see him as a guy that you give him a book and he's like, "Hey, let me make a movie out of this." I just don't think he would care about that.
No. And I believe he passed away.
Yeah. He's been dead for a couple of years now. But he's a very interesting man, and he had some really, really interesting writing, the kind of writing that you might want to call it more intellectual, philosophical type of horror that you don't get get a lot out of. Clive Barker's probably the only one that comes even close to that in terms of some
Neil
of his
Gaiman
books.
Neil Gaiman does it a bit, not as deeply as those two, but Neil Gaiman definitely gets in that territory.
He does, but he annoys me because he just seems to purposely be, you know, anti-Western or anti-Christian just because he thinks it's fun to go in all these different pagan elements. And I don't like when he does something like that. To me, it's beyond the shocking. It's just like you're just trying to be sticking a pen in people's eyes. And I don't really think that's necessary. So that's why I don't really find him as fascinating as a Clive Barker, who he kind of gets down to the nitty gritty without having to, you know, piss everybody off when he's doing it.
Well, and he has a probably what I'd call a more complex relationship to religion than Neil. Although, I mean, well, I don't know, because Neil Gaiman doesn't go, like I said, Neil Gaiman doesn't go too deeply into that as Clive Barker or William Peter Blatty.
And I think the reason why he doesn't, and I'm saying this not really to criticize him, it's just a point of fact, religion to him and his writing is simply a prop, and it's not something that he has anything invested in. And I find that the writers that do have something vested in them, like William Peter or Clive Barker, I just find their material to be deeper and more moving and also a lot more interesting, because you can see how they're trying to navigate some seriously sensitive stuff and still do well, where you know, Gaiman is just like, you know, let's have a guy with three penises and let's have devils dampening everywhere and doing this and doing that and let's intermix 15 different religions, and because it all doesn't matter. And I don't know, to me, I don't really like that. If you're going to mess with the religion, you probably should be somewhat respectful for it.
I like it both ways. I like the way people like Clive Barker and Blatty approach it, but I also like, I guess you'd call them religious anarchists like Neil Gaiman.
Yeah, he's probably right. That's probably the best title for him. Yeah.
I think there's a great deal of value in it. I don't think your viewpoint is necessarily wrong. But I will say that Neil's attitude towards religion somewhat is similar to my own. I take my beliefs very seriously, but I also like seeing them deconstructed and, you know, smashed apart and, you know, parodied and things like that by other people.
And there's obviously a market for that, and I certainly don't have any opposition to that. I just think that some material,
I don't think Neil Gaiman does it from a mocking perspective. Which is more than you could say for someone like, say, Bill Maher.
Right, yeah. I agree with you on that. I don't really think he's sitting there in his house writing about, let me piss off these people and make Jesus look like an idiot, something like that. I'm not saying that he's doing
No,
that.
I don't, yeah.
But what I'm saying is that it's not the corner of his realm, and therefore, to me, it's just window dressing and a prop in a way, just to move things around, and I don't really want it to be seen that way from my own taste anyway.
And it's, yeah, no, there's nothing, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that not being to your taste. There, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But it definitely appeals to me.
Yeah, he has a lot of fans. I know. I talk to people like that all the time. They're like, why are you not into him? And I'm like, I'm sorry, he just doesn't reach me. It doesn't reach me to what he's doing. It doesn't connect.
I had that experience with Thomas Pynchon recently.
Wow.
Where I was like, I just can't get into this guy. And my friends were supportive, but I know they're also like, hell esteem.
Well, I had a lady tell me the other day, she's like, well, I don't understand why you don't get into him, but you don't mind some woman slamming a crucifix into her vagina. And I said, listen, at least that was authentic to the character, okay? Something that rings true.
That does seem like something Satan would do, yeah.
It kind of makes sense to me. Some of the stuff that Neil does, I'm like, I don't know where he's at. I can't find him.
I actually met the woman. I cannot think of her name right now, and I feel really bad about that. But I met the woman who body doubled Linda Blair for the more adult scenes. I met her at I used to go to horror movie conventions, and I met her at one of those.
Wow. Well, I hope that I don't know if anyone's working on it yet, but I hope somebody works on a bio of William Peter Blatty, because I think it'd be one hell of an interesting read.
I'd read it.
Yeah.
There's very, you know, it's really funny. I've read a number of his books, and I've seen I've seen his output in movies, and I've read bits and pieces of biographical information about the man, and I think I saw an interview once, but there's really so much I don't know about that guy, which is interesting when you think about how much his work has affected me.
I do know, and hopefully they'll expound upon this in a bio one day, but I do know that he was a man that was not close to religion or the church. And as he was investigating his first book, that became The Exorcist, that grew into something deeper. Almost like his investigations and what he had discovered and what he wrote about wind up making him a much more religious and sensitive man. And it led to him ultimately doing the Ninth Configuration, which was almost like his way of saying, all right, here's the other side of the coin now, because I'm starting to become somewhat of a believer. So I'm told that he went from agnostic to a believer over the course of his life.
Well, I mean,
through horror, who can believe that?
Well, I think one of the neatest things about The Exorcist is that in its own very interesting way, it makes a case for it makes it The Exorcist might be one of the best positive spins on religion that you could ever possibly create. So it makes sense, and that's the way the movie comes across to a lot of people. Certainly the way it comes across to me. So it makes sense to me that you would say that he would go through that journey, because that definitely, there's definitely a sense of a journey that undercuts a lot of his work. And even in the movie The Exorcist, you get a sense of that. It just goes in a different direction. Certainly when they did the sequels.
Well, yeah,
to bring it back, of course.
His investigations, it wind up being contrary to what some of his prejudices was going into it. I mean, he was walking into a situation where he's like, yeah, these people are probably hitting the whiskey too much, so this might not turn out to be anything. And then he finds people very credible, and he's like, whoa, what the heck is this?
Well, it's always nice to encounter people who it doesn't happen a lot, or doesn't seem to happen a lot, but it's nice to come across stories of people who come into contact with religion and actually do have a positive experience and come out of it a better person. It doesn't come up as much as it should, but it happens.
I agree. I know it has a bad connotation right now between the terrorism and cults and of course, the clergy going after children and all that sort of stuff. So you put all that together and it doesn't exactly add up to a lot of wonderful religious experience. But, it might be more the practitioners than the actual faith itself that could be having the problem.
Well, it's not supposed to be literal. That's that seems to be something that a lot of people lose sight of.
And I got that, but even metaphorical, you can make a case on, yeah, I'm becoming a terrorist because it's metaphorically saying this is what I should be doing anyway. So it's not hard to go that next distance if that's what you want to do.
Because somehow the text is very specific and yet so vague. For a number of different religions, I'm specifically thinking of Christianity, but this applies to several religions. The text is somehow vague enough, is somehow specific enough to be interpreted a certain way, yet vague enough that we have multiple interpretations, many of which are dangerous, and that seems to lend itself very well to very obsessive, angry types.
Yeah, but my question has always been, I mean, is it the text, regardless of how vague it be at times, or is it just the person with another agenda using this to justify their stupidity?
Well, I think what's scary is if you ask a lot of them, they'll tell you it's the calling of their beliefs, and they'll absolutely mean it.
Yeah, and I just don't think they're being honest, because God knows, I've been to the church and I enjoy reading the Bible, and I have yet to want to use it to justify any of my mistakes, and I certainly haven't gone on a killing spree and said God told me or this verse said I was okay. So you have to wonder about people simply wanting to avoid their personal responsibility in their crimes by just blaming stuff, because I don't see how words from a couple thousand years ago harms somebody. They have to make the personal choice to do these horrible things, and to point at some deity or some ancient manuscript, to me, that's just the height of being irresponsible.
Well, I think some people are probably too mentally ill to see it that way, but
true.
I get what you mean.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, and I don't mean to sound like I'm defending all kind of religion, but if you just
look at it
in a logical way, I mean, why is some high priestess in Islam gonna get beat up because a bunch of weirdos decided to shoot a rocket into a bus with children? There's nothing in the Quran about that sort of nonsense. So you have to always look at the people who are perpetrating these crimes versus where they said that they got this information from, because it's just not there. I mean, there may be vague things in all these holy books, but there's also a lot of stuff that clearly say that this is not the kind of conduct that you're supposed to be doing. Innocent children have nothing to do with a political cause, and quite frankly, politics have very little to do with religion. So it's obviously people being twisted.
True. Well, that is certainly true.
Well, I am so happy to have you on here, and I want to remind people,
yes,
of course, about his book, Bondage Night. The cover alone is probably worth it.
Do you want me to just run through the slew of them again?
Yeah, why not? But what a hell of a cover. And as you can already hear, this is a very interesting and a formidable writer here that we want to be able to bring into the art family and talk about in the future again. Yes, please go ahead with that.
Yeah, it's Bondage Nights from Moran Press, which also published my most recent poetry collection, Love and Quarters. There's also A Ludicrous Split, which I wrote with the very, very, very talented and quite handsome Kevin Ridgway. I love Kevin to pieces, and it was amazing to work with him on that book. And there's also, of course, Clouds of Hungry Dogs, which features still one of the best book covers I've ever seen in my life by Frankie Matt, who also helped me put that book together, and is the big wig at the iconic, at least to me, Cleft Jaw Press. And so all those books are available through their respective publishers. They're also available, all of them are available on Amazon. And I'm also selling personal autographed signed copies, so of all those books. So if you really want a signed copy, come on down. I'll write a silly phrase, and gosh, we'll learn a thing or two.
I definitely do that, folks. And Gabriel, don't forget, before your book comes out, you know, send us over one of the short fiction pieces that I love to get published there in Aerial Chart. It's another way to announce that, you know, your book is coming and that you're on the stage. So that'd be great too. Well, we have already published some poetry from Gabriel, so check it out at Aerial Chart as well. All right. Well, I want to bid you a good evening, and thank you very much for being on. It was a wonderful pleasure, and also another unique interview where we get to talk about things we don't normally talk about from somebody that's doing things that none of us are doing, writing about film. How awesome is that? I wish I could do that. I mean, I love film, but I wouldn't be interested in doing it, but I still love the whole notion of it. Thank God I get to do something.
Well, I didn't get to be a filmmaker, so this is what I settled for.
There's nothing wrong with that. It worked for Roger Ebert. No. Why can't it work for you, you know? Come on.
Well, I mean, Roger got to write Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, and the one argument that I get is that I had a stage play that was produced a few times. So if anybody ever calls me into question, I can throw that out.
Yeah, stick with the playwriting, because he didn't get much from that screenplay. But
no, he sure didn't. But he did an audio commentary for it that is absolutely worth listening to.
that's a piece of trivia I didn't realize. That's great.
Right. He seemed very affectionate about that movie and about his contribution to it.
Yeah, I know. He's also defensive about it too. So I'm like, I call him a brilliant film critic, and I'd stop at that, you know.
Yeah. Well, you got to have me on the show again so we can just talk about Roger Ebert for an hour, because yeah. I can definitely do that.
Yeah, he's an interesting fellow. I got his bio too.
I do too. It's sitting on my to read list now.
It's a great one. Thank you very much, Gabriel. You have a
Thank
good
you.
Evening.
Thank you for the conversation.
God bless.
Take care.
Thank you for listening. Please follow the show and visit our blog at strengthtobehuman.blogspot.com.